It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, we have another edition of Valley Edition, and I'm really happy to have Saz Hollander on the phone. Welcome, Saz.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
And also in the studio, we have two people. We have Terry Snyder.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing fine. And coming through the door is Mark Kelsey. Well, let us... I'm going to begin with the event. There's so many things. The event which has so dramatically affected so many people. And that is something that you've been following, Zaz. And, of course, I'm talking about the bridge incident. Maybe you could, for listeners who happen to have missed this, just sort of say, okay, what's going on? What are we talking about?
We're talking about bridge apocalypse. And
there's
Wednesday
bumper stickers out already, you know.
There are bumper stickers. What I survived bridge apocalypse. Early afternoon Wednesday, a 18-wheeler hauling a modular unit on a flatbed. One way or the other, everyone is still figuring that out, at least on an official basis. The load was too big for the clearance, the just under 19-foot clearance on the South Eagle River overpass. And so as this unit came southbound on the Glen, it smashed into the overpass and sheared off the roof and the back wall and did significant structural damage to the overpass to the tune of about $1.8 million fix so far. That's what's been requested for emergency funding by DOT. And the problem is when the module hit the overpass, it pulverized the concrete around this girder, which isn't like a steel girder that you'd see in a skyscraper. It's sounds like it's I don't know if it's rebar cribbing, but it's cribbing, metal cribbing that concrete's poured into. And it weighs like 200,000 pounds, I think, is what DOT estimated. And so the concern was that if you were driving south on the Glen Highway, this thing could fall on you and hurt or kill you. And so that's why the highway got closed and why the northbound lanes were not closed, because drivers on that side weren't in any danger. And so it turned into a huge, epic traffic snarl yesterday morning, in part because the detour around... in part because of commuting from the valley, all the people who commute from the valley, you know, thousands and thousands, and the detour that took them from North Eagle River through into downtown Eagle River out the loop road to Highland. And it was a mess yesterday. We heard stories of people stuck in traffic for 4 to 5 hours. Some of them even got turned around before they got where they were going.
So before we go on, I'm just curious. I know I've read some of the reporting, and it seems like when we're talking about who's responsible, as the investigation will, I'm sure, go on to detail, you have a driver who's captain of the truck rig. You have the people that had the item, the structures that were being carried, and you had some intervening groups as well. And it sounded like it might be a while before you could figure out who it was that was supposed to measure and say this was going to be okay.
Well, the company, the trucking company involved, Bighorn out of Fairbanks, issued a statement yesterday basically blaming a different company. And so I was pretty close yesterday to connecting the dots. So this is a modular unit that was being hauled to Seward. And as part of a larger man camp, right, sort of a temporary cheap shelter for employees, the company that was in charge of the units is a logistics company, and it's a logistics company that is providing a man camp for the formerly named Kodiak Rocket Launch Facility.
Okay.
So I couldn't confirm, but I think that's where this module was headed, to be part of a much larger, you know, 300, say, unit man camp or whatever. You know, a larger unit, a man camp down at Kodiak. which is kind of interesting, too. So there was a logistics company in charge of that man camp. That's who the trucking company is blaming. The logistics company wouldn't talk to me yesterday, so I don't know what their side of the story is. But there's a lot of finger-pointing going on, and, you know, there are basic... The state requires a permit for these kind of, you know, oversized loads. This the trucking company was permitted for up to 17 feet. The clearance at that overpass is 18.8, I think, 18.8, 18.7, something like that, almost 19 feet. And so what the trucking company said in a kind of a vague statement, but more than we had before, was it wasn't our fault. We were led to believe something other than what was loaded. And I don't know what that means. I don't know how, you know, if you're driving truck, how you don't know what your load is measuring. There may have been, I'm sure there's more going on, and there's certainly both two sides to that story. We don't know the other side.
Okay. Well, moving on from the finger pointing to the Friday change, it appears that DOT responded very quickly and created in an overnight activity a new exit ramp that allowed for a change from moving through the center of Eagle River to just a quick little blip off. And as the result was on Friday, partially probably because fewer people were traveling the road, but certainly not anything like what happened on Thursday.
Well, and
yeah, there is less traffic on the road. It's about 40% down from last Friday.
Whew, that's quite a bit. Mark?
Quick self-interested question here. Is it just during drive time that the traffic gets backed up?
Well, it's not even that backed up, but yeah, sure. I mean, when there's more volume on the highway, it's going to be more congested.
And, yeah, and looking ahead, my understanding is by the time Monday rolls around, we're talking here on Friday, by the time Monday rolls around, they're projected to have removed the damaged span. And then with the exception of interruption crossing over on the overpass, people will be able to just travel as normally down the highway.
Even the overpass, I think, should be okay. It's open now, as far as I know, although DOT was going to have to close it when they actually start the repairs, so it may not be open. At Friday morning, it may be closed. It was open yesterday, but everybody was routed. They took about 12 feet of road and just made it off limits, because that's the part that's over this destabilized girder.
Okay, so the overpass will still be functioning, but in a narrow...
On Monday, certainly, yeah.
On a narrow way. Okay.
I think the questions that it just opens so many comments up about, you know, people in Southeast who, when a ferry's down now, we all know how that mm-hmm. feels. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that have been saying commuter rail, we need an alternative method. We're just starting to talk about commuter rail, and the naysayers were at... right away saying that wasn't a solution. And then you've got to know it's election time, and so the Kinnick Bridge is going to be all injected into that too.
Yep.
So it's this may get repaired, but the talk will continue, and you know, it is a valid subject. There should be some type of alternative route, but it's just a matter of what it is, and more importantly right now, where the money's going to come for any of that to happen.
Well, I was
even the repairs, $1.8 million isn't chump change.
No, and I was very impressed with the uncoordinated, I'm going to use that term, response that allowed different agencies and groups and so on to look at the situation and determine what they were going to do to lessen the pressure on the road. The Anchorage School District closed schools in Chugach and Eagle River. And the various parts of the state extended different recommendations to employees. But as you've just pointed out, Zaz, that lessened the pressure on the highway as well.
Yeah, and it should be interesting to see what the economic dollar is at the very end with all of that, because all those adjustments have costs to them. And that should be talked about, too.
Whoa. Okay. Well, and we were coming off another story, which up until the bridge seemed to be the big story. And that, of course, is the opening of the Hatcher Pass Road. I had an opportunity to speak with Hap Wurlitzer, the owner-operator of Hatcher Pass Lodge. And that was just before it was opened. And he's in his own way, pointed out that it was pretty much business as usual, even though there was a limit on travel up and down. Zaz, any quick summary about that or what you saw in that story?
Yeah, that was the 10 people got trapped behind an avalanche. And this is Hatcher Pass Road, which is pretty avalanche prone. I mean, if you drive it at all, you'll see there's a sign warning about avalanches as you kind of start up into the section where slopes get steep on at least one side of the road. That avalanche occurred up above where the Mother Lode Lodge used to be. So I just passed that hairpin turn before Archangel Road and came off Marmot Mountain, which has slid before. And it was a result of the snow we keep getting over and over again, a bunch of fairly heavy snow and wind, and just everything got destabilized and started moving around. And so it's not unusual. I did get an email from somebody in a different state wondering how the heck Alaska can allow us all to drive on these roads when we could get hit by an avalanche at any time. And it's just you couldn't drive to Valdez if roads were closed for avalanche danger, and our state budget wouldn't allow for the kind of mitigation that you would need to keep all avalanche risk at zero. So at any rate, the state responded as quickly as they said they could, given the avalanche danger up there. People were urged not to ski up there. I'm sure some ignored that. And the people who were quote-unquote stuck were in a pretty pleasant situation. There were two guys up at the Gold Cord Mine. It's a private inholding above Independence Mine. And they were playing cribbage when I talked with them. And one of them lives up there. So.
Right.
And the other spends quite a bit of time up there. And then there were seven guests plus Hap at the lodge. And, you know, they were all there to ski. You know, four of them were from Anchorage and probably were, you know, had work or whatever to get back to. But, you know, their cars were there. There was some talk of skiing out before the road was open. And I have a feeling that was discouraged, in part because of the continued avalanche danger the next day, but in part because of the hassle of having to come all the way back from Anchorage to Hatcher Pass and get your car and all that kind of stuff once the road reopened. So it was kind of a fun little story, but also a good look at how quickly things could change here, even when you think you're on pavement.
Okay. Well, the third story I'd like to talk a little bit about is one that just popped up, and it took my breath away. I read it, and that was a story about an ACLU suit against the Palmer Police Department involving something that happened back in August at a local Palmer bar. Zaz, I know you've been focused on avalanches and bridges and the rest of it, but anything about this particular suit?
Yeah, it was kind of a Kyle Hopkins, who's a reporter and project editor at the paper now, and a longtime former ADNer. He wrote that story, and it was kind of hard to read, honestly, just because I know some of those Palmer police officers, and they mean well, and I'm not sure what directives they got from ICE, but yeah, it was a really bizarre, terrible situation, even from the start. There was a really bad bar fight at Klondike Mike's on Bar Row in Palmer, and I believe an employee there came out to protect his bartender, who was getting beat up, and there were three guys involved, and long story short, the employee stepped out to help, who is from Peru and is married or marrying a U.S. citizen and was on his way to citizenship, was taken away in handcuffs and jailed for 4 days. And this wasn't my story, and I haven't had my head out of this other stuff long enough to check, but it's unclear whether the three guys who were actually apparently assaulting someone were even arrested. So the ACLU filed suit against the Palmer Police Department.
Right. And of course, we point to the event happening back in August, and it would appear that this was something that was not bubbling along with a lot of people aware that it was going to come down. But it has all kinds of dimensions sufficient to bring attention from ABC News, from around the country, because of the aspect of a local police force interacting with the feds in terms of what should happen here, how should that cooperation work, and the fuzziness. And from the reporting, which I think was as accurate as it could be at this time, it became obvious that there there was kind of a fuzzy set of statements about why this individual was arrested, held, and then released.
Well, and why there was, I don't know if warrant is the right word, but, you know, when the police ran this guy's name, they saw that ICE wanted him, and that's why they picked him up. And I don't know what that rationale was, why they were looking for this person, why he was on their radar in the first place.
Mark?
So nobody said he's here improperly?
Oh, they did say he was here improperly, but not sufficient to keep him on the road to deportation, et cetera, because he's back, at least as the report is available to us now, continuing his march toward a green card and the rest. But I think we've highlighted what we know to this point. There's a lot of unknown. The thing that we want to bring up is that there will be a special meeting of the Palmer City Council at 6 p.m. In advance of the regular meeting of the Palmer City Council, which is at 7 next Tuesday. And this meeting will have as one item, and that's an executive session to discuss the potential litigation involving the ACLU and the City of Palmer and the Police Department. So I suspect that maybe coming after that will be something that will carry a little more information. Okay.
Or not. Sometimes they come out of executive session and you don't really know anything.
Right. But this is a segue to another continuing issue. Over at the borough, during the borough assembly meeting, there was a large contingent of people who came from the Willowa subdivision over in Wasilla. And the testimony was powerful, and the assembly responded, and the mayor and the manager, by saying they heard what was being said, and they were looking into finding a solution. And Terry, maybe you could say a few words about that, because it's a police powers who does what type of activity.
Right. So, yeah, and it is confusing to citizens to where the boundaries, so to speak, are. And this is really just a few blocks from Wasilla High, not within the city limits, actually in the borough limits. And they have come to testify before about this, but they really were organized this time. And they're just looking for a lifeline here. They have junk problems. They have crime problems. They have kids that can't play in their yards, front yard or backyard. They're feeling like they have to arm themselves, and they want some help from somebody. And everybody knows there's a trooper shortage. They've talked to the city. Ironically, the city is annexing some property just about right across the street from this subdivision, but this is not part of the annexation. And the borough has no police powers, so they're just trying to get attention of someone to do something about their property values dropping because of the crime, the contingent of bad actors that are being pushed out of the cities that have protection and out to the outlying areas. They had Assemblyman Ted Leonard out there Saturday walking the neighborhood with him, and he certainly got an earful and was very sympathetic to it and is seemingly wanting to find a solution. The irony there is that the state solution would be sort of in the hands of his wife, who is the state representative for that area. So the dynasty there, either on the assembly side or the other. But it also brings up a bigger question. I think Assemblyman Jim Sykes brought this up. He's got some problems in the Butte. Everybody has some part, except maybe Mr. Beck, who's mostly city in his area, has problem with crimes in their area. And it's come up before. They've talked about it, but they certainly haven't found a solution. One is maybe to have some police service areas, but that costs money. And who's going to pay for it? Valley residents have been fairly clear, or at least the vocal ones, saying they don't want to pay for anything more, and there certainly doesn't seem to be any money to cover it. So I don't think you've heard the last of it. They have done what they can in a neighborhood watch. They're organizing neighborhood watch. They've wore out their phones calling the state trooper and anybody that will listen. So I guess the ball's sort of in the court of city officials to make some suggestions that will help people who really are passionate about a big problem.
well, it definitely highlights a theme that seems to be common here today, whether we're talking about the bridges, you know, keeping the roads cleared or keeping our streets, you know, crime-free. It's about the cash available to pay for the services. And in these times where there's such a loud continued cry for cut, we need to remember that all cuts come with consequences, and some things really shouldn't be cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the social programs are showing right now.
So
lack of social programs.
I know where Terry lives, and I know where I live. We live in the city of Palmer. Mark, you live in the borough, right?
I do.
And Zaz, you live in the borough.
Yep, that's right.
So how do you feel about your police coverage there or support?
Well, I guess you don't really know until you need it. I have not had any issues, but then I have not had a need to, you know, call and need a quick response from law enforcement either. So I guess I'm really not the best person to ask.
Mm-hmm. Zaz?
Well, I think we've all heard from people who feel underprotected, and I've had personal experience. It was some time ago, so before this combination of budget cuts and recruiting problems,
yeah.
Which is, you could link it to budget cuts,
yep.
But there's more at play there as well. Mm-hmm. But there are open positions the troopers have funded that aren't filled.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a number of years ago, and a neighbor was having a domestic situation, and I knew that there had been situations there before and that she was a danger, so I called troopers, and I don't think they ever came. You know, it was I didn't know if there was a weapon involved. There wasn't, as it turned out. And that was not a high priority that night or morning or early morning. But there have been, you know, countless stories I think we've all heard in the media from, you know, legitimate stories from people who don't even call troopers because they know they won't come and it's kind of a low-level thing, mm-hmm. especially property crime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just tag on one last piece that actually involves the legislature. In a bipartisan spirit, there's been apparently fast-tracking of a bill that would improve the response by security personnel and police forces to incidents in ERs, et cetera. Apparently, there are reports that at local emergency rooms, there's been a spike up in the number of confrontations with unruly patients and medical personnel, and a significant increase. The cause, we can speculate, but the result has been an action by the legislature to make it possible for police forces to act more to earlier in the situation, as the situation is developing, to de-escalate it, to respond to a call more so than has been able under the current guidelines and regulations. Zaz, did you have any information about that?
I haven't had time to look at that.
No. Okay. Well, we'll follow that along, but I think it fits in here with the entire set of things of trying to find a balance of for response that isn't going to be too heavy-handed, that is not that balances individual rights, et cetera. But it's I think safe to say that the whole policing question has attained a new visibility very recently.
It still has. I'm with sort of with Mark or whoever Rizal said it. You have to do something about why we can't hire people. I mean, the city of Fairbanks had to give a $20,000 or some $1,000 worth of bonus just to get someone to take a job up there in their own borough or city. We have, as you know, I think Zaz mentioned, lots of unfilled spaces, and we can blame it on the budget, and we can for some degree because even filled spaces is not enough people. But you know, if you're asking people to go out and risk their lives for a 401k, might be part of the problem. And were we having trouble of attracting people when we had defined benefits, when 30% of their income wasn't health care? So there are some other really big topics that go into this whole conversation, even as we react to, you know, the crime thing.
Okay. Well, I want to shift focus as we're finishing up this week's panel to Washington, D.C., And as we're talking about things here on Friday, we have a number of events that have occurred. One, Congress has passed an omnibus spending bill. The president is threatening to veto it. But for our purposes, I'm looking at how the Alaska Republican senators voted, because they split their votes. And in what is somewhat of a surprise, actually following the lead of the senior senator in past votes, junior senator Dan Sullivan said he couldn't support a bill brought to vote under what he was reported to be a shoddy process. And there's a quote there that says from him that there were about 2,200 pages of legislative text, all kinds of things, huge implications. And he could not support it, and he voted no on that bill, which I found kind of surprising. Mark,
no, that is a very encouraging thing to hear from anyone in the Senate. You know, these stories in the past about approving things that don't get read, you know, that's just not good for the process at all. So if Sullivan thought he needed more time to consider it, you know, that's a valid enough reason to vote no, as long as there's a plan going forward to do something about it.
Yeah, and of course, the senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, voted for the passage and apparently saw enough positive provisions for Alaska in the bill to do it. So, well, just an interesting little sidelight as we go along. Well, folks, I think we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. I really want to take the time to thank Zaz for taking a couple of deep breaths here in the flow of things for participating today. Thank you, Zaz.
Sure thing. I'll be waiting on that pizza, Mike.
Okay. And Terry Snyder, thank you for coming in here.
I want an ice melt this weekend. That's what I'm looking forward for.
And Mark Kelsey, thank you, too, for coming in.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Okay, we'll be back again next week with another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.